Thank you for choosing this ABC Radio National podcast. When it's finished, we'll have details on how you can also download our informative daily breakfast program. So keep listening.
Hello, welcome to the Health Report. I'm Lynn Malcolm, sitting in for Norman Swan for a couple of weeks when we'll look at some of the effects and treatment for drug dependence.
The big four addictive drugs are opiates, alcohol, nicotine and psychostimulants. That's amphetamines and cocaine and the derivatives. And the important thing about those drugs is that they all act on the same part of the brain, coming to be known as the reward pathway. So there's a curious commonality about addiction, despite the fact that we think some drugs are uppers, like stimulants, and some make you soporifics, such as opiates. In fact, they have very similar mechanisms of action.
Do they all have the same capacity for causing addiction?
The most addictive drugs appear to be nicotine and opiates. These are the ones that are hardest to stop. But the probable reason for that is the way that those drugs are taken, or at least the way nicotine is taken by smoking, is intensely reinforcing because a very rapid spike of nicotine gets to the brain each time you puff on the first puff of a cigarette. And that rapid gradient in concentration is what stimulates the reward pathway, just as injecting opiates intravenously produces a rapid gradient. The route of administration and the rapidity of onset of the drug is what makes for the particularly addictive properties.
And do individuals vary? Is it true that people have addictive personalities or addictive brains?
There's evidence that some people do have considerably greater vulnerability than others, and I wouldn't dismiss that, but I think the components that go into that are probably largely genetic, and I don't think it's, talking about it as personality suggests that it's something in one's character or disposition, but I think it's more in one's genes and more at an unconscious level. There is a familial tendency, definitely.
Associate Professor James Bell specialises in addiction medicine and is also director of Sydney's Langton Clinic. Australia has one of the highest rates of illicit drug use in the world. In fact, we are leaders in both cannabis and amphetamine use. And there's no doubt that dependence on any drug can devastate people's lives. I spoke to Paul at a drug rehabilitation centre in northern New South Wales. And what was your drug of choice?
Heroin, mainly. Used pretty much every other drug, but heroin. It's been since I was 13, so 37 now, it's just, I'm just over it.
Just how bad did it get for you?
It's just been a merry-go-round of in and out of jail, using in jail, so, and a number of times I've walked out of jail with a heroin habit, so you don't last long on the street when you've got to get out and commit crime straight away. $400 dull check lasts a day. It's just that constant merry-go-round, which I just haven't been able to step off until now, hopefully. So I've seen other people on methadone and on the bupe that have stopped using. But for me, it was just, I don't know, I'm always chasing more, you know what I mean? So some days I'd get a bit depressed, I'd divert me medication and go and get on and get to that comfortable space where I've been used to being.
Treatment for heroin addiction is complex. And whilst drugs like methadone, which suppress the cravings, are still considered the most effective option to free people from heroin's addictive cycle, Paul is determined this time to stick it out at the residential therapeutic centre called The Buttery. And we'll hear more about this approach in next week's Health Report. Since the late 90s, the number of people becoming addicted to heroin in Australia has declined. But with methamphetamines, it's a different story. Over 70,000 Australians are addicted to these synthetic stimulants, more than double the number dependent on heroin. It's known on the street as speed, base, or in its most pure form, crystal methamphetamine, or ice, which is particularly potent. Candice is now clean after a long, hard struggle with a range of drugs, including ice.
I started to use speed, amphetamines, ecstasy.
Did you use ice?
Yes.
How did that make you feel?
I felt invincible and that I understood everything about myself and I understood everything about everyone else and that I was capable of doing anything. At the worst time, I was having about 2 grams a day. I started off smoking it and then started injecting it.
How was it making you behave?
I remember talking to myself a lot, but I was very erratic and unpredictable at times.
Did you ever experience psychosis?
Yes, I did. Yep. I hadn't slept or eaten in 2 weeks, and I was driving in a car with my 3 children at the time, and I just started feeling really tingly, and my body just gave way, and I had a seizure in my car. And, you know, luckily I was able to stop the car before it took over my whole body, and I was paralysed, and my body was doing things that I wasn't asking my body to do, and I couldn't talk, I just felt so helpless at the time.
Candice got through her addiction problem by completing a rehabilitation program at Odyssey House just outside Sydney. About 24% of people in their 20s have tried methamphetamines, and 1 in 10 of them have used it in the last year. Dr. Rebecca McKeaton is Senior Research Fellow at the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre at the University of New South Wales, and she says that ice, being 80% pure, is now preferred over the less potent speed. So is it more addictive?
Well, we do see that people who use ice tend to be more addicted than those who use other forms of methamphetamine. It's a little bit difficult to say whether it's the ice that has led to them being more addicted or whether it's because they're more addicted, they tend to use the stronger form of the drug. And I think both things are true. One of the concerning things I find is that people will smoke ice where they wouldn't inject a drug. So what we're seeing is a cohort of people who are kind of recreational drug users who might snort or swallow, you know, some speed on the weekends to go out and party and club. Now they have access to ice, which is smokable, and this is a far more risky way to take the drug than snorting or swallowing it. People who are smoking the drug are often using it in a very compulsive way, so they'll smoke continuously throughout the day, and that's leading to quite a lot of problems with those people. They're getting a lot of side effects from their use.
Some of them fairly nasty, as we'll hear. Dr. Rebecca McKeaton and her colleagues run a stimulant treatment program through the New South Wales Health Department.
Well, the kind of people who we're seeing coming into treatment services, by the time they get to that point, they've usually been using ice for 10 or 15 years. And they've also got a lot of other polydrug use going on. A lot of them will be smoking cannabis every single day. They'll be drinking alcohol, using sedative drugs, sleeping pills, to cope with the side effects from the drug use. A lot of them are suffering quite high levels of paranoia and becoming agitated. They also have a lot of depression. It's very rare, actually, to see someone coming into treatment without quite serious problems with depression and often anxiety as well.
And it's often associated with violent behaviour.
Well, we see a lot of reports in the media about people who've used ice who've become quite violent and uncontrolled in their behaviour. These are certainly the minority of cases. But what is driving those types of reports is when you've got a very heavy user of the drug who's experienced a psychosis. At that point, often you'll find it's either the ambulance or the police who've been called in to intervene with this person, and the person freaks out, essentially. They behave very impulsively in an uncontrolled fashion, and that can be very frightening for the police and for the ambulance staff.
And what's actually happening in the brain at that point?
It's a very good question, and it would be great if we had a definitive answer. We do know that methamphetamine, or ice, is a drug that causes a hefty release of a chemical called dopamine. While that makes people feel good and it makes them feel more alert, it's also a drug that's been implicated in psychosis. In fact, the drugs that are used to treat psychosis block that chemical. So what we think is happening is over a period of time with heavy use, that dopamine system self-regulates in response to heavy use of the drug that seems to trigger this psychotic reaction in some people.
There's also a behaviour associated with it, which is picking at the skin.
Yeah, one of the common symptoms of methamphetamine psychosis is the feeling of bugs crawling under people's skin, and it leads people to pick compulsively at those bugs because they really think that there's something there.
What are some of the other symptoms of the psychosis?
The most common one is feeling persecuted. So, for example, you might get someone who believes that their flatmates are giving them a hard time. You also get cases that are clearly implausible, so that they think that ASIO are following them around or there's helicopters tracking them. They think the police are chasing them, so they're trying to run away from the police all the time. they might have hallucinations and see people sitting in the tree outside their house watching them. Common one is they'll think that there are listening devices in the house and they'll start pulling the house apart to find them. They might hear people in the roof. So again, they might start pulling up the floorboards or going up into the manhole to see what's causing the noise, only to find that there's nothing there. They're not the common symptoms, but they do occur. And when people get to that point, that's when they start to get into trouble. And in the extreme cases, they might last a couple of days. However, some people might have a predisposition to psychosis, so they might have an underlying mental health problem like schizophrenia. And in those cases, what happens is if people take the drug, it can trigger a full episode of psychosis, which can go on for weeks to months or until it's medicated.
There's no doubt that heavy use of this drug can have distressing effects, both physically and emotionally. But not enough is yet known about the long-term effects of ICE. However, Rebecca McKeaton says some important information is starting to emerge.
One of the things that's recently been discovered is that heavy use of methamphetamine, even if it doesn't have a neurotoxic effect on the brain, that causes a depletion in the chemicals in the brain that make you feel good. So basically, if you use this drug heavily, while it might make you feel good while you're on it, what will happen is you get a rebound effect where you feel really awful.
Which may in turn lead to other mental health problems like depression.
Exactly. What we see when people come off this drug is they become very depressed. What we don't know is whether or not this drug will lead to a long-term increase in the risk of depression. And it's going to be hard to say whether that's because they had depression to start with or whether or not it's been brought on by the drug. So essentially there's a lot that we have to learn about this drug.
So what about treatment? What do we know about what is effective to treat an addiction to ICE?
Well, essentially the best evidence that we have is that psychological treatments like cognitive behavioural therapy are effective. There's also a treatment called contingency management, which is quite effective as well. That's used more in the United States than it is here in Australia.
And what's that?
Contingency management is essentially providing people with rewards for not using the drug. And it can really vary, but often it's as simple as giving people some reward like a food voucher or cash or some other type of reward for providing clean urines. That's in its most basic form. Cognitive behavioural therapy is a little bit different. It involves looking at the way people think and feel about the world, their interaction with the world, and working with them to change that, to improve their coping skills, to cope with the cravings from the drug use, to identify triggers that will induce craving and relapse to the drug use, and helping them in that way.
And there is evidence that these treatments can be effective to help people quit the addiction?
Definitely. There have been several randomised controlled trials that have demonstrated the efficacy of both of those treatment modalities. In practice, it's a little bit more difficult. In practice, we don't have a lot of people who would be equipped to provide those types of treatment. And often when someone presents to a treatment service, they're not at a point where they're ready to sit down and engage with a therapist in understanding how they think and feel about the world. They're often quite agitated, feeling insecure. They might not have stable housing. There's a whole lot of other things going on in their life that makes it quite difficult to engage with them. So a lot of the actual treatments in reality involve bringing the person in and just giving them somewhere safe and quiet where they can come down off the drug. And it might not be 2 or 3 weeks after that point where you can actually sit down and start working on the addiction.
There are other treatments now that are starting to look quite promising, aren't there?
There's been a lot of work on pharmacotherapies, that's what we call them. It's a little bit like methadone for heroin, which will be able to be used for ICE dependence. So you give people a drug that stops their craving and stops them wanting to go out and take more ICE. Most of the drugs that have been trialled have shown fairly limited success. There are things that are showing promise, but they're just not at the stage where they're good enough to be put into practice.
Rebecca McKeaton from the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. You're with the Health Report on ABC Radio National and via podcast. I'm Lynne Malcolm with today's program looking at drug dependence. Cannabis is the most commonly used illicit drug in Australia. 1 in 3 adults at some time in their lives have tried cannabis, and although its use has declined in the last few years, more and more evidence is emerging about its effect on mental health. Natasha started smoking cannabis in her early teens.
I mean, I've been on taking marijuana for about 20 years. Marijuana's been the mainstay. I had a psychotic episode on marijuana. I basically sat at home and smoked pot for 2 years. So it took a long time to get there, and then when it happened, it was intense. And I was probably quite messed up. And that really, I was sad. I was really sad. The paranoia was full on. And then I took myself off to rehab. They call it a keyhole drug. It doesn't actually do anything to you, but allows your brain to become so feeble that other things kind of creep in.
I think, sadly, the profession as well as the media underestimated the harms associated with cannabis use. And it's really only in the last 7 or 8 years that the data has emerged quite clearly that, particularly for young people, smoking cannabis can produce a long-term psychotic illness, not simply unveil a tendency to psychosis. And the importance of trying to minimise cannabis use by adolescents seems to me to be the highest priority. The other harm that's emerging is that long-term smokers frequently develop all the same sort of respiratory complications as people who smoke cigarettes. But the real issue is adolescence and the risks associated with mental illness.
Dr. James Bell from the University of New South Wales and the Langton Clinic in Sydney. As you heard from Natasha, some people experience psychotic episodes in relation to heavy and prolonged cannabis use. So what's the likelihood of psychosis occurring? Dr. Mark Montebello is a psychiatrist at the Langton Centre in Sydney, where he treats people for cannabis dependence.
If you've got a genetic predisposition, and that's best identified by a family history of a psychotic illness such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, then smoking cannabis will increase your risk of developing that illness. Or if you've already got an established illness, then smoking cannabis will increase your rates of relapse. If there is no family history, then the research is a little conflicted, but there's little evidence to suggest that cannabis alone per se can cause psychosis. You really do need that vulnerability or predisposition.
And can it cause other mental health disorders?
There's emerging evidence that cannabis can increase development of depression, particularly in women who start smoking cannabis at a young age, say in their early teens. Their rates of depression are about double compared to their peers who don't smoke cannabis. There's a lot of evidence emerging about cannabis use and anxiety disorders, and the rates there may be a little bit less than double.
So what do we know about some of the effects on the brain?
The research is quite varied. There's been two good studies recently published in respectable journals that are good examples of quite conflicted research in the area. Okay, Yussel and colleagues in Melbourne did a structural brain scan study looking at the effects of long-term cannabis use and found that it had to be quite heavy use, so at least a couple of grams of cannabis per day, for at least 5 years, and they found that there were certain parts of the brain that were atrophied or were smaller in size compared to normals or people who hadn't used cannabis. What the actual significance of that, they weren't sure about. On the other side of the coin, Freed and others from the University of Ottawa in Canada had found that even with high levels of cannabis use, that the global domains in IQ were not affected by cannabis use. However, they didn't look at particular functions of the brain that might be more affected by cannabis, such as memory or problem solving.
And I guess they're quite significant areas, aren't they, whether cannabis affects memory, for example?
Yes, and that's also critical when it comes to treatment, because a lot of our treatments for cannabis use revolve around psychological interventions. And if the brain is being affected, it probably means that people aren't able to undertake those psychological interventions as successfully as compared to perhaps other psychiatric disturbances which require psychological intervention.
Dr. Mark Montebello. While psychosis can occur with heavy cannabis use, 1 in 10 people who try cannabis will become dependent on it. And the most common symptoms are low-grade mood effects and lack of motivation. Over several years, Mark Montebello has been researching a pharmacological fix for cannabis dependence. But there's no solution yet. In the meantime, centres like the Langton Clinic in Sydney can help.
With the cannabis dependence itself, the best evidence is for short, structured cognitive behavioural therapy intervention. So that usually involves 4 to 6 one-hour sessions with a psychologist or an appropriately trained professional with a very structured type of program looking at managing cannabis withdrawal, setting a quit date, very much like with quitting cigarettes, and then developing strategies to prevent relapse. Often many people have tried quitting before they come to a treatment service such as where I work, and they've already got some of their own strategies, but there's often also a lot of misconceptions where their strategies have not worked in the past. Often they're also smoking tobacco, and they may not have realised that really when they're trying to give up cannabis that they're also maybe reducing their amount of nicotine intake. So they're going through a double withdrawal, and so managing that appropriately with a nicotine replacement. Also problems with sleeping, so teaching them about sleep hygiene and other techniques to help them get a good night's sleep so they're not relying on cannabis to help them sleep. They may actually substitute alcohol or other drugs, so we try to limit that.
What do you know about how effective that treatment is?
There's been at least 10 well-conducted, large randomised controlled trials looking at cognitive behavioural therapy or motivational interviewing or variations on those two main types of treatment. And we know that they do make a difference. The studies tend to exclude people with significant other psychiatric problems or forensic problems. And in fact, they're the group that we probably would want to make the biggest difference with. But my clinical impression with those people that use STORE can make a really big difference. There's a whole range of drugs that young people are going to be exposed to. We often see parents who want to come in and talk with a professional about someone in their family, like their teenage children. So we can actually support the parents. Or the converse may also be appropriate, where the teenager is encouraged to go and talk to a professional and the parents are not a part of that. That way it decreases the pressure on the parents or on the relationship between the parents and their children about managing drugs or drug use.
Dr. Mark Montebello. For more information and advice about cannabis dependence, I'll give you the number for the Cannabis Information Helpline at the end of the program. In recent years, it's emerging that those people who are drug dependent very often are dealing with mental health problems at the same time. It's known as comorbidity, and it makes treatment for addiction all the more complex. Professor Marie Thiessen is from the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre.
We know that there's a strong relationship with alcohol and anxiety and depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. There's also a really strong relationship between cannabis and psychosis, and there's a strong relationship between drug use and post-traumatic stress disorder. So there's interplays going on between those mental disorders and those drug use.
So often you hear stories from people about having abuse in their early lives or some sort of trauma in their early lives, and they turn to drugs or alcohol to numb that, to stop them feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. Many, many people, particularly with heroin dependence and with alcohol dependence, have had experiences of trauma early on in their lives. And that's something that we observed through many studies as well, where we were interviewing 800, 1,000 people who had heroin dependence, and 40% of them told us that they'd had significant traumas in their life. They'd been attacked, they've been raped, molested. It's often with this lifestyle, particularly of illicit drug use, it's not just the one event, it's many events. And for many of them, they keep reliving that trauma with incredible fear and intensity. And that is developed into what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, that can be incredibly debilitating.
Marie Thiessen. Camilla Connolly has been abstinent for over 10 years, but feels her extensive drug use was strongly related to her troubled history.
At certain times in my childhood, there was a lot of physical violence, emotional abuse, sexual abuse as well, and I was taken out to the bush as a prostitute and raped. So I've had to reclaim a relationship with nature that has been almost fraught with trauma and kind of polluted by my experiences out there. So pretty much from the word go, drugs were used as a kind of self-medicating mechanism, numbing myself. You know, it wasn't about fun times at all, really, no, yeah.
Camilla Connolly, one-time resident at the Buttery Rehabilitation Centre in New South Wales. Marie Thiessen and colleagues, along with researchers in the United States, are now trialling some treatments to address substance dependence and mental health problems simultaneously.
Prior to our treatment trials, the feeling was that you couldn't really do the best treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder in people with drug and alcohol problems. The reason being that the best treatments are about exposure. They're about taking the person back to experience the feelings that they had during those events. And the biggest concern you could understand was that if you did that, would the person go straight back to drug use or increase their drug use? Because the idea is that they're using the drugs to relieve that pain.
Because it might be so overwhelming for them.
Might be absolutely overwhelming. So with some trepidation, some groups in the US that we collaborate with just ran a small pilot to see whether that actually happened. And it didn't. And the symptoms reduced and the drug use reduced in these people. So we've now have two large trials running here in Sydney. Amazing that we've got two trials. It just shows the desperate need in this area. And one of them is treating post-traumatic stress disorder in people who have amphetamine or heroin dependence. And the other one is treating post-traumatic stress disorder in people with alcohol dependence. A typical case study may be a young woman in her early 20s. She's had a life of abuse from 12 to 15, having been assaulted by her uncle. Consequent to that, started heavy alcohol use, say 15 or 16 years of age. Consequent to that, heroin dependence. Through that heroin lifestyle, she's had exposure to a lot of assaults and abuse, also assault and abuse because she turned to prostitution in order to support the heroin dependence. And of course, she was using the heroin and alcohol to numb a lot of the pain associated with the traumas that she'd experienced. Not everyone turns to drug and alcohol, but in this particular case, this is the way this individual coped. What we did with that individual was picked for her the one key traumatic event. It was actually a rape that she'd experienced at the age of 18. So we worked with her to describe that attack, what happened during that attack, what was she wearing. It happened to occur in her flat, so there were a lot of triggers going on for her. And to go through the experiences that she felt during that attack, that helplessness and the absolute fear and the pain and the physical sensations. And then it's taking her through our 16 sessions of therapy to describe those events and to understand the relationship between those events and her drug use. It allows her to go through a process of attaching those feelings and emotions to that event occurring at that time, rather than re-experiencing them in her everyday life.
So the idea is that you help people work through these traumas and eventually they won't turn to the drugs to numb their pain.
Yes, yes. And we weren't sure if that was what was going to happen. But happily, we actually were halfway through one of the trials and the results are incredibly positive. It's the amazing strength of these individuals that not only have they reduced their drug use, they've actually also, at 3 months follow-up, they no longer have post-traumatic stress disorder.
Professor Marie Thiessen. That's all in today's program. Thanks to Paul, Candice, Camilla and Natasha for sharing their stories, and to Odyssey House and The Buttery. And to hear more of their stories, go to our website where you'll also find information and links on drug dependence and treatment. And the Cannabis Information Helpline number is 1800 30 4050. That's 1800 30 4050. Production today by Michelle Goldsworthy. I'm Lynn Malcolm. And join me next week to explore how residential therapeutic communities can help people with drug dependence to renew their lives.
If you're not a morning person, the bad news is you're missing the best and most listened to breakfast radio in Australia. The good news is that online, Radio National serving breakfast all day, and everything's on the menu. You pick and choose. The full program, separate stories, subject or commentator. Subscribe and we'll deliver. Details at the Radio National website. Breakfast, it's your choice.